What's the dish?
Hello and welcome back to the Food Safety Dish, a production brought to you by the National Farmers Union's Local Food Safety Collaborative. I'm your host, Kathryn Cavanaugh. There are poisons that blind you and poisons that open your eyes. August Strindberg. It may be safe to say humanity has a grotesque fascination with poison. When we think of poison, we might conjure up images of a bright green elixir bottle with a skull and crossbones on it. We often think of poisons in the context of murder mysteries, a mysterious weapon that causes bodily harm or death with no obvious culprit to blame. Or maybe others think of pollution as the slow poisoning of our ecology. Poison is scary, alluring, dangerous, taboo. But as science has made more sense of poisons over the centuries, we have been able to accurately detect and identify the presence of poisons in our food supply, and sometimes lurking in plain sight. While poisons are generally given a bad or misunderstood rap across the globe, not all poisons are created equally. Pesticides, herbicides, and fungicides are all poisons commonly used in agriculture for crop protection, derived from the Latin suffix side, meaning to kill. We use these chemicals to expressly destroy organisms that can damage our food supply, helping to bring efficient, pest and disease-free foods onto our plates. In fact, an unregulated food supply emerging from the Industrial Revolution cleared the way for a wild west of food manufacturing, usually instances involving cost-cutting corners or extending the shelf lives of food, often with unintended consequences. Rampant adulteration, the term for adding harmful substances to food like arsenic in candy or formaldehyde in milk, plagued citizen populations, especially causing illness and deaths for vulnerable populations like children. In response to this and growing public awareness of the horrors depicted in Upton Sinclair's The Jungle, Congress passed the Pure Food and Drug Act and the Federal Meat Inspection Act in 1906 to curb the presence of adulterated and misbranded food products, ultimately leading to the beneficial technologies like canned goods and better preservation methods and expanded consumer protections. These policies would develop over time to address persistent contaminants and novel additives, culminating in the landmark Food Safety Modernization Act in 2011 that currently defines our food safety landscape today. For today's especially curious dish, we're delving into the history of poison in the United States. It is with great enthusiasm that we welcome our guest, Deborah Blum, an award-winning science writer with a long-standing interest in poison, in our everyday lives, in our history, and in far too many murders. Deborah Blum, director of Knight Science Journalism Program at MIT, is a Pulitzer Prize-winning science journalist, columnist, and author of 6 books. Most recently, The Poison Squad, a 2018 New York Times notable book, and the subject of a 2020 PBS documentary. She is co-editor of the 2022 book, A Tactical Guide to Science Journalism, published by Oxford University Press, and is currently under contract with Penguin Press for a book about female poisoners. Blum won the Pulitzer in 1992 for a series on primate research that became her first book, The Monkey Wars. She has since focused on key moments in the history of science with books including Love at Goon Park, 2002, Ghost Hunters, 2006, and a New York Times bestseller, The Poisoner's Handbook, in 2010. She has worked as a science columnist for The New York Times, a blogger for Wired, and has written publications ranging from The Wall Street Journal to Mother Jones. She was the Helen First Brooke Franklin Professor of Journalism at the University of Wisconsin-Madison for 15 years before being selected as the fourth director of Knight Science Journalism Program in 2015. Shortly later, she launched the online science magazine, Undark, which now numbers a readership in the millions and has won numerous national awards, including the George K. Polk Award. Blum is a former president of the National Association of Science Writers, was a member of the governing board of the World Federation of Science Writers, and currently serves on the board of the Council for the Advancement of Science Writing. She is a fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science and a lifetime associate of the National Academy of Sciences in recognition of her work in science communication. Welcome to the Food Safety Dish, Deborah. We're so excited to talk to you today.
Thank you. Me too. It's a pleasure and honor to be here.
So cool. This is really the first time we've dug into the topic of poison, and I really don't think we could have found a better person to talk to. So all that being said, our first question kind of leads off of your book, The Poison Squad, which explores the fascinating and sometimes horrifying story of the 19th century crusade for food safety in the United States, led by a pioneering scientist who fought hard against chemically enhanced and deceptive food manufacturing practices, and ultimately which paved the way for the creation of the FDA. Can you share the story of the 19th century crusade for food safety in the United States and generally lead us through a broad overview from its catalyst through now?
Sure. It's a really amazing story, and it was an education for me. I am, and I can sound a little creepy sometimes, as you may find during this podcast, really interested in poisons. And so I was looking at early 20th century toxicology, and I kept seeing references to an experiment called the Poison Squad. And I thought, and I'll come back to it, I kept thinking, what is that? And when you look at it, what you find is it's one of the strangest public health experiments in American history because it's a federal chemist poisoning his coworkers. And so what I said to myself as someone who's interested in that topic, why would you want to do that? Why would you, as a federal scientist, be so desperate about something that you would think the only way to get the answer was to do something really dangerous for your young colleagues at the USDA, which is where Harvey Washington Wiley, who's the focus of my book, was. And that led me into taking a look at 19th century food. Right. And that led me into realizing that I had long swallowed this, what I think of as the foodie mythology of the 19th century. Wonderful farm fresh food for all and happy, healthy, pink-cheeked Americans, you know, picking their apples and eating only amazing, wonderful food. And that's just completely not true. So when you actually look at the 19th century, there's two things going on. We have the rise of industrialization in the United States, a migration from, you know, a very rural, not that the rural economy doesn't stay, but people migrate to the cities because there's work there. And because we have the rise of industrialization, you get the rise of cheap manufactured food. And what makes that particularly dangerous is that there's zero regulation of food or drink, or actually drugs or cosmetics or anything. There's zero consumer protection regulation in the United States in the 19th century. The U.S. is resistant to it, you know, for a whole complex of political reasons. And so the manufacturers who are providing food, especially to the cities, can do whatever they want. There's no requirement for them to put labels on the food. There's no requirement for them to actually put in, say, a can of food what the advertising on the outside of the can says. There's no requirement for them to safety test what they put in the food. There's nothing. And so what happens in my story is that Harvey Washington Wiley, who had been an analytical chemist at Purdue in Indiana and started looking at fraud in food, is recruited to be the chief of the Bureau of Chemistry at the USDA. And at this point, there's no EPA, there's no FDA, there's no consumer protection agencies at all. And at USDA, there's about a dozen chemists, and they're responsible for everything farm in the United States. And so they've never done food safety because they've got pesticides and they've got, you know, soils and they've got plant chemistry and they're exhausted all the time. But Wiley comes in. He's the son of a crusading itinerant preacher. His dad had actually been a conductor on the Underground Railroad during the Civil War. He has this deep belief that science is here to do good, and he directs his department to start looking at the American food supply in the 1880s. And that series of the reports, it's got the incredibly boring name of Bulletin 13, is like a case study in the horrors of the American food supply, Right. They start with dairy, they look at vegetables, they look at wine and beer, they look at canned meats, they look at canned vegetables, they look at just the whole range of the American food supply, breads, grains, the works, cocoa, everything. And they find two things. One is the amount of fraud is really insane in the 19th century. So if you look at the reports from the Bureau of Chemistry, you'll find that spices are somewhere between 90 and 100% fake, right? So, and they don't mess around with what they put in the ground, the cans of ground spices. You know, they use brick dust in cinnamon and paprika, same color. They use dirt in pepper. Often they would just sweep the floors of the factories and dump the dirt in it. They use ground shells in pepper. They use ground bone in coffee. They used to grind up bones, dye it to a dark shade with black lead and dump it into the cans. And coffee itself, and I take this personally because I'm a big coffee drinker, but coffee itself was usually about 70 to 80% fake. And in fact, it was so fake that people started like trying to shift over to coffee beans. And you can actually find the recipes for how to make these fake coffee beans. There's just a new trade in making fake coffee beans that are mixed in with the real beans. And I actually read a statement by a public food chemist from the Midwest who said that he thought the origin of the phrase a muddy cup of coffee, which you sometimes hear in the United States, is because people were drinking so much dirt. So, and I can go way beyond that, right? There was strawberry jam that contained not a trace of strawberry. It was coal tar dye, corn syrup, and grass seed, right? And that actually came up in congressional testimony in which the manufacturer of the jam said, hey, it's a competitive market, and if we actually put fruit in our fruit jams, we couldn't match the prices of our competitors, right? And then fortunately for us, we're telling you what's in it, but we have to tell the consumer. It just says strawberry jam, and it's, you know, kind of red, and it's got seeds in it, and so you've got this landscape of fraud. And then you've got the even more risky problem of the fact that you can put really dangerous things into the food supply. So red lead was used quite commonly at that time to enrich the sort of golden colors of cheddar cheese, right? Make it more cheddar-y looking. You would use lead to color it, right? Arsenic was a green food coloring. It was used in candy. It was used in cake decorations. It was used to make chocolates shinier. But the one I often focus on is formaldehyde. So formaldehyde was synthesized in the mid-19th century, and it turned out to be an incredibly effective embalming agent. It was the number one embalming agent used in the American Civil War. And the American dairy industry had all these problems with milk at the time. One, it's all raw milk, right? So there's no pasteurization. And in the 19th century, you see an insane number of really pathogenic bacteria growing in milk. There's no hygiene standards in dairy. They had bovine brucellosis. They had tuberculosis, bovine tuberculosis. You know, just drinking milk killed kids in particular. But then there's no refrigeration. It's the 19th century, right? People, if they have money, have ice boxes. If they have no money, try to put the milk in the coolest corner of their apartment or whatever. The milk rots. And so the dairy industry literally says, hey, look at formaldehyde. It preserves bodies. Wow. What could it do for milk?
What could go wrong?
Yes, exactly. And so they start putting it in milk, and it's great. It really works, right? It kills the bacteria. Formaldehyde, I'm saying this because I've heard it. I've never actually, you know, swigged any formaldehyde, but it has a sweetish taste, and so it would cover up some of the taste of the rot. And it would definitely slow down the rot. And you can find dairy ads from the time say, buy our amazing milk. You can leave it on the counter for 2 weeks. Right? And it'll just sit there. It's like from today, you're like, ew. But but then it was like this miracle of science. But again, there's no requirement to safety test. There's no requirement to tell anyone that you're putting formaldehyde in milk. They didn't even call it formaldehyde. They made up fancy names for those formulas. And of course, there's nothing to regulate this. So a lot of dairymen would go, well, a little formaldehyde is good. What about more? and you start seeing across the United States what they called embalmed milk scandals, right, where the milk is so full of formaldehyde and it's so poisonous that it starts killing children across the country. And it's completely legal, right? There's no one's prosecuted because it's not illegal to put a poisonous thing into the food supply. So by the time Wiley, and I'm taking him now right to the turn of the 20th century, has finished doing these investigations, you see that his introductions to those reports change from, here's an interesting report, to, can we please do something about this? Could we at least label the food? And you see him saying in these reports, either there are children and there are sick people, some of them get milk several times a day, they get this food several times a day, they're getting cumulative doses of these really bad things. Can't we at least let them know if we're not going to regulate? But Congress at the time, I'm not saying that I believe this has entirely changed, obviously. There's a lot of, the more things change, the more they stay the same. But Congress is incredibly corrupt at the time. Right. There's a famous early 20th century book called The Treason of the Senate, which is just about how corrupt the Senate was at the time and all the money they took from big industry that made Teddy Roosevelt so mad that he started calling investigative journalists muckrakers, right? The people who raked the muck at the bottom of the, you know, sludge pile. And so the industry just keeps dumping money into Congress, and Congress keeps saying, no legislation, no legislation. Wiley tries a number of times, and it's not until we get into the early 19th century that we start to see change, and there are two factors driving that. One is the poison squad, and I can tell you why. And then the other is the book that brought us the Meat Inspection Act. And that's Upton Sinclair's The Jungle. And there's a synergistic effect between those two things. Many, many people know The Jungle, right? It's often been long considered one of the most transformative novels in American history, right? Because of the scandal it kicked off. But that scandal blew up because Wiley had been running those poison squad experiments for a number of years, and they'd gotten national attention. And he had tested formaldehyde in food. I mean, he did it because he could not figure out another way to get the information out or to persuade Congress that this was really dangerous, right? And to make the American public aware that they were dining really dangerously. He wanted that information out there. So one of the great successes of the Poison Squad is it gets coast-to-coast coverage, right? It's in minstrel shows. There's songs written about it. But more than that, when you look at the newspapers that are covering those findings, they all say poison, right? They don't say food additive or, you know, interesting substance. They're like, you're eating poison. These men are eating poison. And so you start getting this huge kind of public outrage and anger. And then Upton Sinclair goes underground in the meatpacking houses of the Chicago to do the research for his novel. And Sinclair was a socialist. He was trying to write a book about the plight of the immigrant workers in the stockyards. There's a famous quote from him about that book, which you've probably heard. You know, I aimed for America's heart and hit it in the stomach. And so, but the book was so detailed as to the horrifying nature of what was going on in the packing houses in Chicago, right, that when he first wrote it, his first publisher, Macmillan, refused to publish it. They were just, this can't possibly be based on anything true. And when he found another publisher, they sent fact checkers to Chicago. They wouldn't publish the book until they had fact checked it. And the fact checkers came back to Doubleday Page and said, it's worse than in the book. And when they published it, and of course this huge storm arose, Teddy Roosevelt sent fact checkers to Chicago. And they came back and they said, it's worse than in the book. And the book is grisly, right? But there was an 80-page report that was done by Roosevelt's inspection team that's never been fully published. And Roosevelt used it to blackmail Congress. And when he first said, if you don't give me a Meat Inspection Act, he wasn't even trying for a Food and Drug Act at that point, right? It had so much opposition. But he was trying to get a Meat Inspection Act through, and Congress wouldn't do it, again, you know, serving the industry. And so he released about six pages of the report. The rest of it, I am told, is buried in some vault in the National Agricultural Library, never to see the light of day. But he released 6 pages of that report. It was published in the New York Times. Everyone in Europe canceled their contracts with American meat suppliers. The Meat Inspection Act went through within just a couple months, and it pulled the Food and Drug Act over the line, right? And so we got those two laws in June of 1906, the Meat Inspection Act and the Food and Drug Act. They're very different, right? But they're a paradigm shift in the United States, because now for the first time in history, the American government says we're in the business of protecting people in their everyday lives. They'd never done that before. There were no federal laws. There were state laws that did it, but there were no federal laws that did that. And so we laid down this huge paradigm shifting moment with those two laws built around food, really, right? That lay down the foundation for everything that follows from the EPA onward. And eventually, of course, the Food and Drug Act, which is a mess thanks to its long problematic history and all the antipathy of industry when it first gets implemented, is replaced by a much better law, the 1938 Food, Drug, and Cosmetics Act, and that created the modern FDA. So you see this kind of arc going forward, right? But Earl, and I'll tell you, and this is one of the reasons I think it's what I do actually matters, is that one of the congressmen said to Wiley early and during the many losing battles that until the American public is aware and understands that this matters, you're never going to get the legislation. It's never going to happen. And so this is also a moment when we start thinking we need informed consumers, right? And I think that's 100% true today.
Wow. Fascinating and horrifying indeed. Yes. I mean, I think it's so true, though, like about the, you know, people, I think there's this common assumption that food is safe until proven otherwise. And I think that is exactly the case of people, unless they're aware. How can you care about something that you don't know about? And I mean, if you know that you're being lied and deceived to, like, it's pretty outrageous. I mean, the whole formaldehyde in milk, that's nuts. I mean,
it was crazy, right? And I was talking to someone about it when I was working on the book, because I was really shocked by the 19th century, right? Mm-hmm. And he said, well, you know, in the United States, we suffer from regulatory memory failure. We don't remember what the world was like before we got these laws put in place. And I say to people, if we, you know, we tend in this country to demonize the word regulation. It's really consumer protection. 99% of regulation tends to be about protecting people in their everyday lives, right? And I wish we could teach us to think of it that way, you know, not an insult, but an effort to take care of each other, which it really is.
Parameters, totally. Yeah. That's so interesting. I mean, I have this fascination with the Victorians, and they're so weird, and like arsenic and the clothes, I guess now in the chocolate and just like all sorts of things. That's so interesting.
Just jumping in for a minute, there's a wonderful book by an environmental historian. It's called The Arsenic Century, which is about the Victorians primarily. And you're right, arsenic was in everything, right? It was insane.
That's also probably why people didn't live so long as they do these
days.
One
of the reasons,
One of them. I'm very curious, from your perspective, what are some of the common themes for food safety that you've observed and read about throughout these centuries? And I guess maybe, would you say that food safety is kind of an ongoing journey for humanity rather than a destination? Like, maybe we're never going to be fully there, I guess, because people are always, you know, there's more people or, all that kind of stuff. So, what do you say about that?
Yeah, that's a good question. So when I was doing the book, I mean, the idea that food was unsafe or fraudulent didn't start in the 19th century. You can actually go back to some of the writings of ancient Greece and ancient Rome, and they're talking some about adulteration of wine, and you'll also see them talking about problems of lead poisoning, right? The Romans wrote a lot about the problems of lead poisoning because they were lead poisoning themselves all the time, right? They used lead vessels. One of the reasons people used to think, I learned that tomatoes were poisonous, but it turned out that the problem was they would slice up tomatoes and they would put them on lead serving plates, and the acid in the tomatoes would leach the lead. And so so it wasn't the tomatoes, it was actually the serving plates. So you start.
They were led astray.
Yes, oh, that's very good, actually. So you see this for hundreds of years, right? And in Europe, a way which was ahead of the United States on this, and I think continues to take a more careful route in looking at what goes into food than we do at this point, right, in some ways. Mm-hmm. But there's a very famous book about poisonous food from 1820 that was published in London, A Treatise on Food and Their Adulterations. It's worth just looking at the cover of that book because it's got this fabulous skull bubbling out of a cauldron on the cover. But it really focused on heavy metals, arsenic, lead, copper sulfate, right? And their contamination in the food supply. And that started a conversation in England that led to their first food safety law in 1860, you know, decades ahead of us, right? And that was actually precipitated by an arsenic and candy crisis, right? And it's one of the other things that I think you see throughout regulatory history is that often there's a huge crisis or a scandal that precipitates it, right? The Jungle and the Meat Inspection Act. With the 1938 Food and Drug Law, it was elixir sulfamilamide, that was a children's cough syrup. It was sweetened by antifreeze, diethylene glycol. And dozens of children died, and it was not against the law. And there had been, again, a lot of crusading, and it tipped over. You know, EPA followed a lot of the scandals associated with what Rachel Carson and some of her colleagues were doing. And even if you look at FSMA, you know, there were some major food scandals that helped. There was Peanut Corporation of America. As a famous example of that. And someone was telling me when I was going off about peanuts that there was also like a multi-million dollar ground beef recall. It was like 30 million pounds of contaminated beef that was recalled. And so those kinds of problems helped push FSMA over the line. So I think you see some of that. But you also see in Europe, which tends to be less high, we're all about individualism, and more about we're a community and a collective society in the way they operate. Something I would advocate that we could do better. But they tend to they got a lot of these food safety laws in earlier than us, and they tend to be a little more aggressive taking things out of the food supply if they think it's problematic. So, you know, we've moved forward. It's still not perfect, right? I mean, we could talk about some of the very public food scandals, but one of the ones that didn't get a lot of publicity was after the poison squad came out, I did a series of talks for the food safety folks at the FDA. And I was down at the FDA headquarters, and one of their analytic chemists was talking about the problem with fraud in olive oil, which is not a big surprise to anyone. There's a lot of fraudulent olive oil. And a lot of it comes from Europe, right? It's shipped to the United States. And they were testing at the FDA labs, and they were seeing that it was, you know, cottonseed oil or whatever, but that they were using copper sulfate, one of the heavy metals from the 19th century, to green it up. And they were picking up copper sulfate in their tests, right? So I was like, wow, right? And then I was talking to a friend of mine from Romania, a journalist in Romania, and she says they still find brick dust and cinnamon in Romania, right? So I think it's important to recognize that we're way ahead of where we were in the 19th century, right? If you just take the United States, medical historians will tell you that food was one of the top 10 causes of death in the United States in the 19th century. That is not true today. And all of these consumer protections and safeguards and standards that we've put in do protect us. Do they do enough? No, we don't fund them well enough, right? We don't always enforce them well enough. we tend to, there's continued industry government handshakes that allow things to seep through. I wouldn't pretend that's not. This is not me, you know, saying all industry is tarnished, but if are there always bad actors? Sure, because if not, a few years ago, we wouldn't be seeing copper sulfate in imported olive oil, right? So we have to have these protections in place. They absolutely keep us safer. We can complain about whether they're enough, right? But we haven't suddenly, there was a book by the Harvard guy, Steven Pinker, The Better Angels of Ourselves, suggesting that we had suddenly turned into a more wonderful civilized society. Jury's out, right? I mean, we're probably not as murderous as we were in the Middle Ages, but are we, you know, suddenly in a society full of angels who would never harm anyone else? We're not. So let's, you know, at least acknowledge that and be smart about it.
Yeah, that's interesting. It, I mean, it does seem like a lot of this is reactionary to crises or scandals. Like, it has to cause kind of a sensation for people to pay more attention to it. You know, it kind of makes me think about how there was that lead in applesauce squeezy packets for the kids a couple years ago, and I was at a food safety conference, and they were like, yeah, lead is, like, it has a sweetness to it, it makes it heavier, but there's also, like, no, like, minimum safe lead exposure.
Lead's really dangerous. And I was talking, I've been doing some talks to state regulatory societies recently. I went to one in Illinois that was kind of the upper Midwest, and I did one in Kentucky in February to the Environmental Regulatory Association of Kentucky. But in Illinois, they were talking about the rise of lead, that they were seeing this huge increase of lead in products, and one of them is cinnamon. You've probably seen some of those stories about lead and cinnamon, and I think it was Consumer Reports who did some of the testing. They concluded that the best cinnamon was McCormick, right, at this point for low lead levels. But they were talking about exactly what you're talking about. The manufacturers put lead in the ground cinnamon. It adds some weight, so they don't have to put so much expensive cinnamon in there. And it's sweet, so, you know, you don't pick up on the flavor. So, you know, well, as I was saying, this is an ongoing battle, right? In a kind of Star Wars, like, good against evil sense, I guess, right? We're always battling the evil empire in food safety.
I was also thinking about the applesauce outbreak, too, as we were just kind of talking about all these different adulterants. And then also thinking, too, about as maybe recently as like 10 years ago, Naked Juice had that the recall because they had formaldehyde traces. They figured out there's a huge adulterant of formaldehyde. So when you say earlier, you know, like the more things change, the more they stay the same. I feel like that couldn't be truer with some of the just the additives and things we do know and don't know about with our food system. It's wild.
That's a really smart point. And, you know, one of the things that we do obviously much better than the 19th century is we have labels. Those labels aren't 100% transparent, right? So, you know, occasionally I'll go on a rant about natural flavorings, which are almost never natural, right? They're usually, you know, it's a lemon flavored whatever, and it's industrial acetic acid, right? And I think one of the consumer watchdog groups actually pushed the FDA into removing a couple of natural flavorings because they were, you know, suspected carcinogens in the last 5 years or so. So the other part of this, and it goes to that point I was making about copper sulfate in olive oil, is that you want people to be informed consumers, but you actually have to tell them, right? I've never talked to anyone who said, oh, yeah, I knew about that copper sulfate in olive oil, right? I knew about it because I was at a meeting at the FDA, right? But we need, as part of this, and that goes to all of it, you know, the formaldehyde in apple juice, lead in cinnamon, or applesauce, or you may remember some of the scandals about arsenic in juice, apple juice, back in the day. We need to get the information out there. It's unfair to say to people, be an informed consumer if we're not actually informing them, Right. And there, I think our government has not always, you know, been aggressive about outing some of the problems. And recently, and I worry about this, there was a romaine lettuce contamination study, you guys probably saw this, that was started in the fall, concluded in February, and when FDA lettuce published it, they refused to disclose anything. They wouldn't say what the source of the contamination was. This is in February. They wouldn't say what the who the companies were that had grown it, where it occurred in the process, right? So so we do see, and I worry about this, and you know, the informed consumer model going forward, in the same way that people were not informed in the 19th century. They had no idea what was in their food or what the source of the contamination was. We do not want to go back to the 19th century, right? It's really important for all of us to try to get that information out there. And I hope to try to hold the government to that standard, right?
Yeah, and the more I hear about this in the first 30 minutes, it's just interesting to think about this kind of regulatory amnesia we have about how things were, and also maybe how like knowledge and awareness aren't always correlated with habit change. That's something that gets my mind trotting. But the question I have, you know, as we're talking about some of these more current cases, what do you see as some of the biggest and most pressing food safety issues today?
Right. So if you're looking at produce, right, during the first Trump administration, some of the regulations that limited the amount of contamination in water that could be used for irrigation were rolled back, right? And we've never returned to that fully. So a lot of times when you're seeing some of these recalls of produce, there's a recall going on now of vine-ripe tomatoes. I think it's in 14 states at the moment, right? You're really looking at that problem, right? I mean, and one of the things with tomatoes is that, you know, as they grow, the skin splits a little bit, so it's really easy for bacteria to get into tomatoes in the same way, you know, people will fly cantaloupe for that reason. The skin splits as it's growing, and so it's really easy for contamination to get into cantaloupe. So one of the things to me in produce is just the quality of the actual growing and processing. I want us to say, we want that water to be really clean, right? We want to hold irrigation standards. And I recognize there's economics and there's reasons to want to reuse wastewater, but let's clean it up, please, right? Because we really don't need people being sickened in 14 states because of salmonella in tomatoes, right? So, and you begin to get an issue of trust in the food supply that can have a serious ripple effect as well. So I think, you know, in terms of, you know, what the FDA oversees, that kind of produce, we've certainly seen a number of romaine lettuce recalls as well, right? It is really an important issue. You know, high quality in the way that we process and really hygienic standards in the way that we're caring for vegetables and all of the above, right? That's nothing new. I just don't think we're doing it well enough. And I know the FDA, even coming into now, is seriously underfunded in terms of food inspections, right? There was a GAO report in January that made the point that FSMA, the Food Safety Modernization Act, tries to set a standard for FDA inspection of processing facilities at least every 3 years. And the GAO report from January said they're not making that target, right? And that tells you they don't have they didn't have the inspectors then. We definitely don't have them now. So the other thing that I think is going to be increasing concern is, you know, quality standards in the processing plants themselves, right? You actually need someone to take a look. Right. You can trust. And I want to again say I'm not like saying that everyone who manufactures food is evil. And there's certainly litigation pressures on companies, among other things, to have them do a really good, clean, safe job of processing food. But there are always going to be bad actors, right? The Boar's Head Listeria contamination in the fall was a good example of that. That factory was filthy. Right, absolutely filthy, and it hadn't been properly inspected, and people got sickened across a broad swath of the United States, right? And it echoes some of the things that happened with that Peanut Corporation scandal. I think that was about 2008, so that was a while back, in which their processing of peanut butter was absolutely filthy. I mean, dozens, I can't remember how many people died from, you know, what was in the peanut butter in that. And that was one of the few cases where the head of the company went to prison. Right, it was that bad. But one of the things that they had done, and that had happened here in Virginia with the Boar's Head plant, is they had carefully been able to avoid being inspected. So we need the inspectors, right? There's only trust goes most of the way, but it's never going to go all of the way, right? We don't want to roll this back. We absolutely want. I think that both the thing I'm saying about romaine lettuce and the things I'm saying about inspectors are really part of what I see as one of the big challenges for us today. We need people in place to make sure the system stays honest, and all of us want the system to be honest. We do, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and thinking about our food supply, maybe we can kind of jump into poison here. What does poison tell us about the world, our willingness to use it? You know, a lot of companies voluntarily agree to use artificial compounds in their products. But if these things are here for a reason, why would industries voluntarily change?
Well, first of all, let me go back up a little bit. Our relationship as a human society with poison is really fascinating to me, because we do have this love-hate thing with it, right? We both fear it and talk about poisons as if they're incredibly evil things, and like, yet they make life so much easier for us, and we use them in all kinds of ways, right? We trade off the risk against the convenience of the poisons, right? And we've done that since the dawn of poisons and manufacturing and everything else, right? Your point about arsenic in the 19th century is a great example of that, for instance. The use of pesticides, right? Pesticides are incredibly convenient in terms of growing at a large scale, and a large scale, or even a small scale, right? If you're not going to be an organic farmer, right? It's Alfred Lord Tennyson, Nature Red in Tooth and Claw. And I've often thought, you know, like, I know farmers who feel like they're just at war with nature, right? And that pesticides are the arsenal. But we see this throughout society. We put all kinds of really risky things into the environment, right? And they're incredibly convenient. Plastic's an example of that. There's lots of evidence, right, that compounds in plastics are really bad for us, but they're incredibly convenient, right? You can have the freshest produce in the world and it can still be sitting there in plastic, right? So, you know, that's another probably more nuanced example of the same thing. We've always had this kind of relationship with poisons, I think, throughout history, including the homicidal relationship with poisons. So if you looked at arsenic in the 19th century, you know, it's in everything. It was in wallpapers and fabrics and candies and candles. They used to call them corpse candles in England because they off-gassed arsine gas when you let them, but the arsenic in the candles made a composite candle that would burn a lot longer, so people would go for the convenience, right? I mean, we're smarter than that now, right? We hope. So we used to use arsenic used to be one of the most popular pesticides, it was calcium arsenite and what was the other one? I'm thinking calcium. It's used a lot in apple orchards. And when I lived in Wisconsin, which was where I lived before I moved to Massachusetts, you could find, they actually had maps for where you couldn't grow, because they had used lead arsenate as a pesticide, and the ground was still so contaminated that everything you grew pulled up arsenic with it, right? And that's one of the problems. It's not the only problem, but when you look at arsenic in rice, right, a lot of that's just the naturally occurring arsenic in the soil. Arsenic's a naturally occurring element. Rice is a really interesting grain because it loves metallic elements, right? It'll pull arsenic, it'll pull cadmium, right? It's the only grain that really does that effectively. But some of it is planted where there used to be cotton fields in the south, and there they used arsenic pesticides. So a lot of when you go out and you map arsenic contamination of rice grown in the United States, a lot of it is in those southern areas where there was heavy use of arsenic pesticides, right? And I want to say it's been like 10, 15 years. There was a huge scandal about arsenic in apple juice. The Chinese were using arsenate pesticides on apples, and China was at that time, I don't know if it is now, obviously, one of the big sources of apples for applesauce and apple juice. So one of the things I'm forever saying to people is we should put geographic labeling on our food. Where was it grown? Right. So then it's like if you're worried about arsenic in rice, buy Himalayan basmati rice, right? It's got the least arsenic of any form of rice. So why can't we just do that, right? But again, that goes back to being an informed consumer. So throughout society, we've known that arsenic was a homicidal poison. In the 19th century, it was so widely used as a homicidal poison, it was known as the inheritance powder, right? And so and when Britain passed its first arsenic control law in the 1880s, because women used it so frequently, they had it everywhere in the house, you know, in cosmetics, in the kitchen, whatever. They actually debated forbidding women from ever buying arsenic in England because they thought a woman who had arsenic was too dangerous, right? So, you know, so we have this period where everyone knows that it's a homicidal poison and it's used for homicidal reasons, but hey, let's put it in candles, right? It's really a classic example of what you're talking about. And today we know that, you know, there's all kinds of problems with forever chemicals and with plastics and with some of the longer lasting pesticides. You know, some of the risk depends on how volatile it is, right? So some of our concerns about contamination in the environment are, you know, when we look at PFAS or we look at flame retardants, is those things don't go away. They last forever, right? We've known there was flame retardants in peanut butter for a good decade, right? And yet we still do it, right? It's so convenient for us. So, you know, I think that really defines this really complicated relationship we have. We know it's terrible. We know it's poisonous. We know it's murderous. We know that it's likely going to harm us. We still use it anyway, right?
Wow. Isn't in peanut butter, is that a stabilizer, the flame retardant? Like, why do they put that
they
there?
Don't. It's a contaminant. It's like when you look at the study, and I think this study was done by the University of Texas. I'm trying to remember because I wrote I was writing Poison Pen, which was about contamination in everyday life for the New York Times before I had to give that up when I moved to MIT. It was really sad. But one of the things I wrote about was about the pervasiveness of flame retardants, right? And one of the places they had found was as a contaminant in peanut butter. And because flame retardants are also forever chemicals, they're designed to last forever, right? You don't want your pajamas to burn, right? They would put them in kids' pajamas, right? And it was only retrospectively that they started going, wait a minute. And that's the other thing about us, I think. We're always like all gung-ho for the next best thing. And although we have a whole history of saying, hey, we jumped right into that and oops, that turned out to be a problem, right? We do it again and again and again, right? I mean, one of my examples of that from the Poisoner's Handbook is radium, right, which was used to make luminous paint for clocks and dials and and zinc together in a formula where the radium would bombard the zinc and it would make a kind of blue-green glow. You sometimes see that still, like they'll artificially create that blue-green glow in watches and clock faces. That was based on the color you got from using radium, which is, of course, a radioactive element, right? And the women who painted those clock faces died terrible deaths. They swallowed the radium, right? It destroyed their bones. And there's been quite a bit of coverage of that recently, but at the time, people were like, oh, radiation, it's the next best thing. They would drop like blocks of uranium into swimming pools at spas so that people could bask in the energy. They would put radium in cosmetics. They put it in candy, right? They put it in energy drinks. It's like, it's just so incredibly cool. And yet now we're all really careful about radioactive elements and we get how dangerous this is. And we do that over and over and over again. We do that with pesticides. We do that with new compounds like flame retardants. You can make a case that, and this has nothing to do with our conversation, that we're doing it now with AI. Ooh, next best thing. We won't really think about the consequences of that. What that's going to mean for society. What that's going to do to the whole employment situation in the United States, right? It's just, it's cool. It's new. It's next best thing. And so with poisons, you also see that, right? That it's just super cool. It keeps milk on your counter for 2 weeks. It's the next best thing, right?
Well, I think that really speaks to another question that we were thinking about as we're learning from you. Like, what is the history of things like this, you know, getting adopted into, you know, say the food system or the agricultural system, like pesticides getting labeled for use, or, you know, we have food additives, to get a little wonky, that are generally recognized as safe, but sometimes those aren't necessarily so. And we've seen that recently with some of the changes at FDA. So, you know, how do those things that are poisons, you know, in the name of efficiency or industry or whatnot, get introduced into the system and then, you know, perpetuate?
That's such a good question. So, you know, we... And that really builds on my point. You know, if you look at the miracle of chemistry, you remember the 1930s, DuPont had that slogan, better living through chemistry, right? And so part of it, and this I think also is fairly, I wouldn't say it's only an American thing, but this embrace of the new and the exciting, right, brought a lot of compounds into circulation in the United States, right? Arsenic gave way to, you know, chlorinated hydrocarbons like DDT about the time of the 1940s and everything. And DDT, which was not arsenic, which everyone knew was awful, was the next best thing, right, then, and so forth. One of the problems is that we don't have the apparatus to keep up with what's safe and what's not. We never have. And if you look at the toxic substances control inventory, I think it's something like at least 60% of the industrial compounds that are in circulation in the United States have never even been tested, right? We don't put money into the actual safety testing. We have rules on the books. We just don't fund it. It's too expensive, right? There are parts of our testing apparatus in which we require industry to pay for part of it. That's true with pharmaceuticals, right? Pharmaceutical companies pay user fees that helps fund the safety testing there. That doesn't happen so much on the food side, right? You don't see, you know, cereal manufacturers dumping a lot of money in the FDA to safety test their products, right? It's not a requirement of that law. So we have this underfunded system in which we have a lot of chemicals circulating. And in the United States, we've adopted grass generally recognized as safe. There are certainly compounds that have come into the food supply through one of the ones I tend to use, although I don't think it's like one of the most toxic things, is titanium dioxide, which is a whitening compound, right? Long used in hardware stores, right? Help make paints whiter and brighter and everything. People did not drop dead from having titanium dioxide in their paint, generally recognized as safe, so now it's in the food supply, right? And it's used to make pastel colors and candies and things. I don't think that's a perfect system, right? But if we want to have a more perfect system, then we have to have more people doing the safety testing, right? And one, and two, we have to want to get the information out there. And one of the things that we are also seeing at the FDA and some of these federal agencies at the moment is the complete collapse of the system of getting the information out there, right? I think the entire FDA communication staff was downsized out of existence, right? So who tells these stories, right? It puts more pressure on you guys, right? It puts more pressure on journalists like me. And it's not that it was ever perfect, but you have to have the two things hand in hand. You have to actually have some better system for safety testing. We've got it. We don't fund it well enough, right? If it was me, and I was, you know, queen of the world or whatever, but if it was me, I would look at the 1,000-ish compounds that the EU has pulled out of food, drug, and cosmetics that we allow here. And I would make a list on that data, and I would have a priority list of the ones that really stand out for them, right? I think you could just do a basic literature search that would give you some answers. Not all the work has to be done here. I've actually never understood why we don't do that, right? All of that really fabulous work that's done in other countries. Why don't we just build a library of what we know about these compounds without killing ourselves to do it all ourselves, right? So I would actually do more of an international approach to some of this safety. I would work more collaboratively with the, you know, the food safety folks in the EU. I would recognize that food safety is not a U.S. issue. It's a global issue. Food comes to us from all around the world, right? We should be doing this together. And I think if we would really do that and do that well, we'd make everyone safer. And one of the things I do want to say about things like food safety regulations is they're incredibly democratic, right? If you take formaldehyde out of the food supply, sure, you're protecting rich people, but you're protecting poor people, right? These basic safety standards are a we're in this together kind of approach to things, and that is really good for all of us. Did that answer your question? I kind of rambled through.
No, it was a beautiful answer, and I think that that last point really speaks to something of the kind of, if I may be so bold, the civic virtue of, you know, a well-informed public and a strong regulatory and scientific and research system.
Yes.
And we understand some of the underfunding and uncertainties, but one of the things that I think has been woven through this whole conversation is the notion that, you know, if the consumers, if the public don't know about the dangers facing them, then, you know, how can they understand? We've had a thing, we work with a lot of food safety educators, a lot of producers, and there's a delicate balance of being able to say, like, oh, well, I have all these food safety certifications on my farm, so my food is really safe, and then being concerned that the consumer will say, well, why are you telling me that it's safe? Shouldn't it be safe already?
Right.
And I think that's the gap in the education, and how can we, as, you know, supporters of producers, of people that want to have a safe food system, and then you, you know, as a science communicator, as a journalist, what role does that serve right now in talking to the general population, and how can we do that better?
Yeah, that's such a good question, and it's something that we actually wrestle with in science journalism. I mean, I've been a science journalist since the 1980s, which is way too long, right? So that's sort of the part of journalism that I live in, and we've talked a lot about those kinds of issues. During COVID, which is a different issue, it was like there was so much misinformation about both the virus and the vaccine. And so we had like these sort of, you know, incredibly distraught conversations. Why aren't we getting this information out? Why aren't people understanding? Why don't people understand herd immunity, right? Why don't people understand how a mRNA vaccine works and why it's so incredibly safe, right? And how come we can say this over and over again and it doesn't get out? So one of the big challenges, I think, for all of us is really thinking about the fragmentation of audience. I wrote a piece in the New York Times about food safety a couple weeks ago. And I know that the New York Times audience is already the educated audience, right? So the audience that I'm most interested is not, I mean, I love writing for the New York Times, and I like writing for an audience that gets what I do. But the audience that I'm always trying to figure out is the audience that's not getting this information, right? People in rural communities and red states who don't know what they're eating is dangerous, right? Or don't know the source of the contamination, or aren't getting that information partly because small newspapers are disappearing and partly because they're listening to a curated view of reality in some cases, right, that isn't giving them the information they need, right? And so I think a lot of it is, and which is actually one of the reasons I like what you guys are doing, is us thinking, how do we get this information out to all audiences, right? We don't want this to be the selectively informed, you know, Northeastern community consumer, right? We want it to be everyone. And so I think one of the challenges we're looking at now is how do we reach beyond those who, I always think of it as the people who are already at the science campfire, right? I'm the daughter of an entomologist, by the way. So, you know, pesticides speak to me anyway. But I grew up in science. I've, you know, always lived in that kind of world. Most people don't, right? I was on a committee at the National Academy about communication of science, and they did a survey asking people when was the last time they talked to a scientist, and the number one answer was my dentist. I saw my dentist last month, right? And it made me realize, you know, that people don't actually interact with the people who are doing the research often, right? They tend to think them as the other. That's led to some growing mistrust of science in this country, even though really a lot of the science is telling us things we really do need to know. So we're also kind of looking at that issue too, with the idea again, which I, you know, tend to come back to, that I'm not only trying to protect people like me, that doesn't interest me, right? It's not that I want to kill off people like me, but I'm interested in the people who aren't like me. How do I reach them, right? So one of the ways I do it is partly through, I can use the book as a platform to go out and talk to all kinds of different people around the country in all kinds of diverse ways, right? It's led me, and I want to say this too about American consumers. I go out and I talk about poison a lot, and I certainly know a lot of ways to kill people. I mean, more ways to kill people than the normal person should ever know, right? But I've been in like little community settings where people have asked questions that I didn't know the answer to, but people in the audience did. And the one that always stood out for me was, why is chocolate poisonous to dogs? And I was like, so someone asked me that, and I'm like, oh, right, I'm only interested in killing people. I don't really know about dogs. But people in the audience knew. There's a compound in chocolate called theobromine. It's a stimulant. If you're a human and you eat chocolate, theobromine peps you up. Chocolate makes you feel better, right? But if you're a dog, it stimulates you to the point that your heart can go into overdrive, right? So it's a different species reaction. I didn't learn that from my brilliant research. I learned that from people in a small town in the Pacific Northwest, right? That's a really useful thing to know. So the other thing I think is really important when we have these conversations is to get that people are mostly smart about this stuff. They actually care about it. If they're having a conversation with someone like me, it's because they actually want to know, right? And so when I'm talking to scientists and my friends, I'm saying, well, you know, let's figure out a way to do this in which we're not like lecturing from the mountain on high, right? It has to be a conversation. Right, we're having a conversation with people who care about this idea, and I think that's fundamentally important in the way we communicate this. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. We so appreciate that perspective, and it's definitely something that the National Farmers Union and all of our partners on the Local Food Safety Collaborative try to think about. We talk a lot about different modes of communication and, you know, meeting the growers and processors and producers, you know, where they are in their, you know, civic, cultural context and what they've got going on. Oftentimes, you know, even someone that cares about it, you know, food safety might not be their top concern because they're worried about staying in business or, you know, a dozen other regulations that they also want to comply with or need to be worried about. And we want to help people understand, you know, the kind of greater good of what that can do in terms of how they're producing food, but also some of the, you know, benefits that it can bring to them as a produce grower, as a small cottage food manufacturer, stuff like that. So. Yeah, no, we really appreciate that.
I appreciate that. And I have to say, and I'm not saying this because you invited me on, but I'm now a huge fan of what you do, right? I'm going to follow your work. I think it's super cool.
Thanks, Deborah. And I think it's amazing to hear from yours as well. And what you were just saying to Billy about scientific reporting and just like basic consumer citizen understanding of science. It really has made me think that, especially, and then recently, is just like the combination of art and science, I think, is one of those bridges to help us get there. And I think that's what you've done with your novel and all of your the various forms of writing that you've taken, throughout your career. And a little bit what we're trying to do, I think, with the podcast is to, you know, have this like mixed media outlet so that people can find, you know, information in a maybe more exciting way than just like going to find and read scientific papers, which is probably not something that many people are doing all the time. So, you know, I think just like finding those points of collaboration where the science can be artfully interpreted and articulated to people is something that I've been just thinking a lot more about how we could really use that in an effective way.
I think it's terrific. And the last thing I'll say about that is, so I use a lot of, as you sort of reference, narrative writing skills, in which I want to tell you a good story. There'll be science in the story, but my real thing is I want to tell a good story. The American poet Emily Dickinson has a fabulous poem about that. It goes, "Tell all the truth, but tell it slant. Success in circuit lies," and it ends, "The truth must dazzle gradually, lest every man be blind." And so it's really about it's really about storytelling, right? But I also think it's really important to sends the message, you just don't go out and just hit people over the head with this, right? Mm-hmm. It's a conversation. Yeah. It's a process, right? Mm. Emily Dickinson is my favorite poet, so I'm unexpectedly working her into almost every conversation I have, right?
I love it. Well, thank you so much, Deborah, for spending some time with us and telling us all about your very specifically interesting and incredible area of expertise. I feel like we all learned so much today. Thank you so much for being here.
It's really been a pleasure.
Yeah, this was amazing. I feel like we only scratched the surface. Totally. So I can't wait to dive into more of your work after today.
It could be a lot creepier. Yes. Right?
Oh, I imagine. And I guess on that note too, Deborah, is there any for interested listeners, if they want to learn more about Poison or other further resources that you might be able to kind of point us to, what would you suggest people looking into if they want to learn more about the kind of work that you've been up to?
So, I'm working on a book about female poisoners that probably won't come out until next year. I may start a Poison newsletter once I get a grip of myself, but I'm not there yet. There's a book that just came out called They Poison the World by Mariah Blake that really looks at some of the issues with forever chemicals and PFAS. It's a fabulous book, right? There's a book that just came out last year. Was it last year or early this year? It's called American Poison. As you can see, I read a lot of these things. And that book is about the history of leaded gasoline, and it's about one of the great consumer advocates, Margaret Hamilton, who went to war against leaded gasoline starting in the early 20th century. And both of those books are really interesting, and in their own way, and this is something I think is really important when you're looking at sort of the weight of toxicity, which is that individual people who plant their feet make a difference, right? And so you see in Mariah Blake's book, really just Americans in their everyday life standing up and making things a little better. And you see in American Poison, a woman who is a leading national crusader at a time that women were barely being let into college in some places, right? Changing the world. And if I go back to the Poison Squad, you see this one incredibly determined chemist who fights for decades to get food safety in the United States and win because he doesn't quit and he doesn't give up. So if I could leave anyone with that message, I think, we can all feel really overwhelmed by events. It's really important to remember that stubborn people who don't give up make a difference.
Definitely. That's a beautiful note to end on. Thank you so much.
Thanks. Thanks, all of you guys. This has been great. I've really enjoyed talking to you.
If you're interested in learning more about NFU and the work that we do, or becoming a member, check out our website at www.nfu.org. This podcast is supported by the Food and Drug Administration of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services as a part of a financial assistance award, number 5U01FD006921-05, totaling $1 million with 100% funding with FDA HHS. The contents are those of the authors and do not necessarily represent the official views of nor an endorsement by FDA HHS or the U.S. government. I'm Katherine Kavanaugh, and this has been the Food Safety Dish. Until next time.